C1S, number 21B.
Then in the next point, a spirit, we see that the healing Christ cannot be subdued by people adhering to opposing systems like atheism, pantheism, theosophy, agnosticism, and so on. She says here that the side note is opponents benefited. You see the tone of spirit in it. That truth cannot be opposed. That there are not opponents to truth. That even those who think differently than we do, if they are atheists or agnosticists or theophysts, they are still men. And she says that their moral condition, 32, the moral condition of such a man demands the remedy of truth more than it is needed in most cases, and science is more than usually effectual in the treatment of moral ailments. It shows that they may believe in opposite systems and so on, but as a man, they are still under the government of truth, and they can be healed and benefited by science, because science stands above everything. Science is undenominational. Science does not ask, are you a Hindu, are you a Muslim, are you a Jew, are you an atheist, are you a Christian scientist, are you a Roman Catholic? They all can be benefited by science. The moment their inward longing and attitude for truth as such, and not for a denomination, is awake and is ready to receive help. I think this is an important point, because we know that in the Christian Science movement it has become more or less a habit that everybody who is not a Christian or not a Protestant, if he is a Roman Catholic or a Jew or a Muslim or I don't know what, he's considered a second rate and to beware of. Why? There's no reason for that. We find very often that especially Roman Catholics have a very strong faith in God, a very great trust in God. Sure, if they are full of fear that if they leave the Catholic Church or if they do something which the Catholic Church does not agree, that hell and high water will come upon them, that it is better perhaps to leave them in peace. But so often we have Catholics that are greatly benefited and quickly benefited in healing by Christian Science. So let's drop that limitation which has nothing to do with life, that we classify people as such and such and such and such. The only classification for people is that they are an idea of truth and can be benefited by the Spirit of God, and that they are all under the benefit of the Divine Spirit. The next tone of soul, the side heading is God invisible to the senses. You get at once the sense that it has to do with soul and soul testimony against physical sense testimony. I have epitomized it here that this healing Christ cannot be subdued by the belief that God cannot be perceived through the sense. Well, this is not really a very important point, because I think the age has grown out more or less of that age where the argument was that if we can't see God, it doesn't exist. I think more or less we have the world as a whole has overcome. No, that's saying too much, that the world as a whole has overcome that, because I just remember that when the first Russian astronaut was orbiting the Earth, he sent back to Khrushchev a message and said, I have orbited the Earth and I haven't found God in heaven, so he mustn't exist. So apparently they still thought that if we cannot see God with our eyes, he does not exist. But we know only too well that God is to be perceived and tangible only to spiritual sense, that God is spirit, that he is mind, and that he is life, truth and love, and that therefore God can only be perceived and understood spiritually. So this fact that God is not tangible and understandable through the five physical senses cannot in any way hinder that we understand God. The next point is the last paragraph from 140, and the marginal heading is anthropomorphism, showing that this Christ cannot be subdued by the belief in anthropomorphism. That, like the Jews who had a man projected God, and most of us in the world have God as a mortal magnified, see, a human sense of God, that even that God is a man projected God, that God should be made in the image of in the human image, that this cannot hinder that we begin to perceive that God is principle and must be understood as a principle. It is true that this is a great hindrance in some way, because most people still feel, quite unconsciously, that God should be so as they think he should be, that he should act so as they think he should act, that he should behave so as mortals think he should behave. Especially in prayer, we know that the theological prayer is usually such that people regard God just as a mortal magnified and attribute to God ways and means and characteristics which are purely human. And that it is for most people quite a big thing to get rid of the sense that God is not the human magnified, but that he is something very different than that. That he is a principle, therefore unhuman. I don't say inhuman, but unhuman. Is that right, if one can say so? And must be understood as what he is, and not as what we believe God is. So in spite of the fact that mankind as a whole, in all religions, in all cultures, have always projected their belief of God into the God image, that in spite of that, life, which is truth, life has impelled the truth about God to come through and to be known to men, just as we have it in Christian Science, perhaps in the purest way. I think this is one of the outstanding signs of Christian Science compared with all the various new evolution in theology, that the others still have a God as a human personality and have a personal relationship to God, and make out of this personal relationship one of the main groundworks on which they build their theology. It is difficult for them today still to accept that God is just principle, that he is not a person, and that he has not a personal characteristic, but just principle. And actually, when one goes on discussing it with them further, when one comes to the question of man, then naturally there is not much coincidence with theology. They still believe in the man as a corporeal man, as a human man, as a humanity. But to think that they would be willing to drop the name man at all, completely, and just see that reality doesn't know a so-called man, but that principle only knows its own idea, and that we only attribute to principle's idea the name man, is something still very new. But in spite of that, we will see that life, which is truth, and there is truth, and therefore that life will work and work in all the various sciences to the point where they begin to realize that man is idea, or even further, that they drop the term man and see that all that there is going on is idea. I think with Jung's psychology, he comes very near to that point, because he has already seen that man is only re-echoing the cosmic archetypes that exist in the world, and so that he is only a a combination, really the summary of archetypal experience. Well, archetypes are really original images. I don't want to say original ideas, because in his psychology he still has positive archetypes and negative archetypes. He hasn't gone to that point where Christian Science has gone, where we see that the real archetypes are ideas. That nothing in the world, in existence, is ever having value but original ideas, the ideas of God. So, to summarize this point, we would say that even that belief in a man-projected God, and perhaps also in a man-projected man, that cannot hinder, that in spite of that, the age is here where one begins to realize that life is only expressing itself as principle and principle's idea. I long to see and to experience myself more and more that day where in my consciousness falls the term God and the term man, because it's the most freeing thing one can touch in those few moments when one realizes it. And unfortunately comes back to this world and begins again to look at people and to think about people, and people is hell, especially other people. But really, I feel that the time is approaching and approaching where we will be able, through our culture of the system, to be more consciously aware that we only have to deal with principle and principle's infinite idea, where the term man falls. And I can't think out the freedom we will get when we have no more to take people into account in our thinking, where we just see the science of the Christ. And the science of the Christ is the calculus of ideas. It's not the calculus of men. It's a calculus of ideas. Well, we can call that calculus of ideas, we can call it the compound idea man, but it's just going back again to the old terminology. But it would free us more and more to see that we replace man with the term compound idea. The next stone, life, is something which we can understand also very easily. The side note is more than profession required. Instead of profession, which is required by theology, we have in science the Christ spirit, namely that we leave all for Christ, that we set aside even the most cherished beliefs and practices. Instead of profession, there is demonstration, practice, the living of the Christ truth. In theology, when one wants to become a member of a church, one has to subscribe on the dotted line the doctrines they have. It's profession. They don't ask more than to sign it on the dotted line, what their doctrine is. whereas a living theology demands a living profession, and that is practice. That's the living manifestation of the doctrine. And so life as truth demands that this truth, is a living profession, and so asks to live the divine precepts. Then we come to the next tone of truth, sub-tone of truth, where we see that the healing Christ cannot be subdued by scholasticism and ecclesiasticism. By scholasticism and ecclesiasticism. The side note is no ecclesiastical monopoly. Here, the question is, through what channels really should revelation come? Through what channels should healing come? Should revelation come through the schools, along the line of scholarly and ecclesiastical descent, through ecclesiastical monopoly? Well, that's the usual belief, that the church is instituted and the schooling of the church in order to hand down revelation from one generation to the other, to hand it down through the hierarchy of the organization from the top to the bottom. We know that too well in all the churches, in the Roman Catholic Church as well as in the Christian Science Church. There are very few in the field, in the rank, on the front, fighting, who don't care about the headquarters. But usually it's the ecclesiastical monopoly that dictates what is right and what is to be thought and what is allowed to be thought. Well, that must break down, and it will break down, and it's breaking down. You can't help it. Every church tries to maintain itself through that hierarchy, through that tyranny of indoctrination, and through raising fear for all those who are going against that ecclesiastical monopoly. But then life is truth, and that life does not allow truth to be subdued forever. Truth is stronger than ecclesiasticism, and perhaps we had very few ages or eras in the Christian church just as now, where so much dissension is going on in the established churches, in all the churches. We just think of the Roman church, very seldom, perhaps with the exception of the few big reformators, we have today an enormous rebellion within the Roman Catholic Church against the doctrine or against the tyranny of Rome. You know very well from your country how Professor Charles Davis, yes, got out of the church, and with some very good reason, and that he, as far as we have heard in our little country about him, there were quite a few other Catholics that joined him and went out of the Roman Catholic Church. Don't know if you have heard about it. And the same is true in other countries, and the same is true in Rome. The last council in Rome has really shown us that the progressive truth has been winning quite a bit of terrain, of ground, you see. And I think the same is true in the Christian Science Church. As far as I know from those who have been in Boston recently and talked with the big boys, one could feel that there is a definite insight that they can't go on with the policy of dictating to the branch churches and to the individual what they are allowed to think and are allowed to do. I think we will approach and see a period coming also in the Christian Science Church of a greater freedom for the individual to break out. The mere fact that Canon was allowed to give that talk, which is absolutely against the manual, so to say, is a first sign that there is a freedom breaking in. Well, it must, because truth is bigger than Boston. Certainly is. Then, see, she says, what is really the ecclesiastical head? She says, well, the only crowned head is immortal sovereignty, not the person. The only priest is spiritualized man, not the director, not the lecturer, not the teacher. And all believers are become kings and priests unto God. Each one in us is the highest. Each man is the highest in that hierarchy of spirit of the spiritual church, because each one is the king and the priest unto God. There is no hierarchy in the sense of higher and lower, but there is only the reflection of the one God. Then the last tone of love is showing that the healing Christ cannot be subdued by the very fact that the pulpit and the press and the institutes of learning are not giving enough attention and justice to Christian Science. We feel that if the pulpit and the press and the Institute of Learning would open their doors freely for Christian Science to enter, that would help Christian Science. I wonder if it would. I wonder if today 100 universities in the world would come along and say to us people, look here, we give you 100, what you call, seats, or 100 seats in our university to teach Christian Science. How many could we send? Could we send 100 who could stand there, who would be able and equipped really to put up the standard of Christian Science, that it would really be a help? I think we are not ready. I think when we are ready, it will happen. But I don't think that we are ready. Because if we were ready, it would happen. It's always a spiritual idea that is in command of a situation, not the other way around. It's not the universities that have it in the hand if truth is going to go forward. It's a spiritual idea that is in command of the situation. And if within us we grow in the stature and manhood of the Christ enough to be as well secure in the teaching and practice to put up a right standard of Christian Science, then it will happen. But if we are honest to ourselves, we haven't reached that standard. Anyway, I don't think I have. Anyway, no. So let's be clear that we not blame the pulpit, the press, the school of learning. True, Mrs. Eddy said that Christian Science must have its place in the institutes of learning. But we shouldn't blame the institute of learning that they don't open their doors. We have to make the grade. And if we make the grade, it will happen. Nothing will be able to stop it, because life can't be stopped. And life is truth. And so the truth of teaching and preaching and practice will not be stopped. The moment we are ready and great enough inwardly to do it. So let's first grow inwardly in grace and in strength and in spiritual insight and spiritual power, that we can securely take a seat at the universities. Because only for a university to say, come along, you can have a seat in our university, is not the end of the question. Then it only begins. Then the attacks will come. Then the questioning will come. Then the critics will come. Then we will be bombarded from every side of the various sciences. And then we have to stand. Are we equipped for that? We may get equipped for that, but we aren't yet. So the job is in us. And we jolly well must realize and be honest to ourselves where we stand. And then, just the last tone now of love, life as love, I have summarized it as saying, through welcoming the whole Christ, a superficial sense of Christianity is whipped out. So life, which is love, will not allow a superficial Christianity to survive. Today, really we see that religion is dominated or really imbued, or no, we can't say imbued, well, that a superficial Christianity is to be seen in all the churches, all over Christianity. I don't know what the statistics say in England. The statistics in Switzerland say that only 11% of the Protestant people go to church regularly. Only 11. I don't know if we will call that a very serious Christianity, a very wholehearted Christianity. I would call it a superficial Christianity. Not that people, because only 11% go, not 100% go, but just the other way around, that the church doesn't offer more than to attract 11%. That's the superficiality of it, that the church doesn't attract more than 11. So, life, which is love, wants to integrate all that is good in the world into one Christianity, and not to have it segregated into a church organization and into many church organizations. The church is universal. I have here a note from Tolstoy, who said about his church and ecclesia, said, upon this rock, the understanding of the brotherhood of men, I will build my church. So the church is the understanding of the brotherhood of men, according to Tolstoy. And we can see today, well, the church is the understanding of the infinite relationship of all ideas in the whole universe which constitute our church. And this includes all the sciences, all the walks of life, everything. It is integrated into one church. And every superficiality in this church will be wiped out by the impulsion of life. Life will not allow this superficiality to go on. And so she asks here that the poor and the stranger are not excommunicated from the church. The poor are the seekers, the poor in spirit. And the stranger is science. Science is the stranger within thy gates. This is what any church doesn't like. They don't like the seekers, nor do they like the intelligent thinker, because they will always question their doctrines, which never stand on solid ground. So they have to put out the meek and the poor and the thinker. Well, let's see that within our consciousness we establish a church which takes in every seeker, every one that brings in a new thought, a new idea. Even if it shocks us, even if the old feather beds are a bit shaken, let's see that we don't resist that. That if somebody begins to voice something which we haven't heard, which we don't like, that we don't go at it, but that we either weigh it and see if there is anything in it. If we don't agree with it, let it, but without sectarian bitterness. Because we know from our own lives that what perhaps we have heard 10 years ago from somebody and we resisted in our heart, and 10 years later we say, oh, that fellow was right after all. We never know how our consciousness and how our spiritual development will be in 10 or 20 years. So let's be careful that whatever comes inward as a new thought, as a new idea, that we don't reject it bitterly if we don't understand it. If we don't understand it and can't accept it, let it be, gently, go on and set aside as something that may be true just the same. But then if we are not bitter against it, even if we haven't accepted it, it can grow within our consciousness. And so often I see, when I look back over the years and years, I know that when something as new has come to me and I didn't like it, or I was shaken by it, or I didn't feel drawn to it, that very often, a year afterwards, 5 years afterwards, 10 years afterwards, I saw, oh, that's what he meant. Oh, that's what it means. Oh yes, that's wonderful. So we never know where our way will lead us. And therefore, love knows no accuser, knows no attacking something or idea.